Rusty money remains the bedrock of stability. The soul of money is trust.
I think we are not paying sufficient attention to the law of unintended consequences.
In the immortal words of the Doors, the time to hesitate is through.
Eric Kaysen, how are you, man?
Hey, man. I'm good. A little tired, but functioning. How are you?
I'm functioning, man. It's a beautiful day. Let's go talk about Bitcoin. I always say it on this pod, it's a huge privilege and a little bit like therapy to chat to other Bitcoiners and come away feeling energized, juiced, as Peter Dunworth talks about it. But anyway, how did you discover Bitcoin?
So like many people, you know, I just had a first passing touch at it where it was just sort of a curiosity. And that was, I think it was late 2011 at an Occupy Oakland protest, like a mass anarchist kind of in passing was like he was like, we all understand the money's fucked and like Bitcoin solves problems like Bitcoin.
Interesting.
And he's like, yeah, it's like a decentralized internet money. And like that was it. And I was like, huh, okay. And then I don't think I looked at it for a few months. I was like a far left socialist activist at this point in time, part of Occupy. And it felt really powerful being involved with that. You know, like everybody really got it. Like, you know, Wall Street was the problem and how money was being made was the problem. And we needed to stop that. But very quickly, as I discovered, that most people really just wanted to talk and be heard and to kind of complain about the situation, not to actually change it. Or at least to change it was only through a political perspective. And so I guess this was through early 2013, I sort of watched that movement get compromised and start to collapse. And that was probably like the most emotionally painful experience of my life, because from there I collapsed into, you know, the deepest depression I've ever been in. You know, like I think if I hadn't have found Bitcoin, I probably would have killed myself in that, because I just felt so hopeless about the entire situation. But yeah, like meanwhile, I'd been in graduate school at the time, actually. I'd been studying to become a therapist, and the school, you know, they had a lot of those woke values and shit going on. And as I became more radicalized in my own activism around Occupy, I essentially came up against that system and realized, because part of the program was, it was a dual degree program to become like a school therapist as well, like a school counselor. So I was working at a school at the time, and just sadly and unfortunately, I saw how much these people didn't want to work with these kids or empower them in a meaningful way. And so that really got my own radicalism activated against them. And also, like, because I'm pretty sure I was like going into a manic episode at this point in time. Because there was like a good 4 months there that I was sleeping like only 2 days a week. And that was like 2 hours a week.
Holy
waking
shit.
Up super motivated. Yeah, and being like, let's go change the world. And this was early 2013 in San Francisco. I had actually registered and ran for the House of Representatives, because I was just like, I could just get elected and we'll all crush this thing out and it'll happen, you know? And it was nice. I got a fair amount of support, my signatures and stuff. But In the end, getting kicked out of graduate school and not having a job and watching the Occupy movement fall apart, it was just crushing. You know, and I just sort of fell apart. And as I fell apart, I moved home, lived with my parents for a bit, lived with my girlfriend's parents for a bit. she somehow managed to find us a place to live. And like, I was at this point in time, I was just like barely dragging myself out of bed to just go sit outside and just try to not think about killing myself. And in this, I started, you know, I think I came across the Wired article for Bitcoin, and that was like my second touch. And I was like, oh, wow, like this is really, really interesting. And I had a background in, I had studied at university international relations and history. So I was pretty well primed to kind of understand the economic implications of Bitcoin and the possibilities that it could really present to have a money that wasn't controlled by the state. So it was like mid-2013. I'm like pretty curious about it. I like don't have any money to speak of. I'm like totally broke. But I keep reading. I'm pretty interested. And I had a couple jobs trimming marijuana at the time. And so I got paid in cash. And I remember like the first time I had some real money, you know, I bought food and, you know, helped pay for rent and that thing. And I think I had like $500 left over. And I talked to my girlfriend at the time, and I was like, I really think I should like buy some Bitcoin. Like, I really believe in this. I think it's like a really cool and interesting project. And she was like, yeah, like why not dabble in it and try it? And so I did. And that just kind of evoked my curiosity, and like my journey down the rabbit hole started. Yeah. And I remember very distinctly like going to a 7-Eleven and like using like the red Western Union phone to like call up Mt. Gox and be like, hello, I'm like wiring you $500. Please don't lose it. Yeah, it was just fascinating. And as I sort of got deeper into it, this is like mid-2013, Coinbase started, and I like really wanted to try to work. So I applied, they had a management role. I went and interviewed with Brian and Olaf. And I thought it was funny because they like gave me like a bunch of like SAT questions and shit. You know, like if you have, you know, like 7 bars of gold, like how do you like weigh all of them, like using a balanced scale?
Really?
And like, how many windows are like in San Francisco total? You know, and it was like, and I remember like that question, I got really flustered and frustrated. And they're like, oh, okay, like it's fine. You know, and they're like, we don't think that this is a fit. And I felt really defeated and upset about that. And I'd been working at a temp job at a credit union, and they had actually given me like a full-time role. So I took it. And that sucked because it was like helping geezers clear their web cache and cookies, you know, so that they could like log in and shit. It was awful. But I did my job. I did decent at it. Good enough that they wanted to promote me. And so this was fall of 2013. They give me an offer to be like their director of technology. And it was funny because I was talking to the CEO of the bank, you know, it's like a 500 person credit union. And I was like real excited because I was like, I'm going to try to like orange pill these people. I'm going to get this bank to, like, bank to like do Bitcoin. Obviously that did not go over well. But it was real funny because right after that happened, Olaf reached out to me kind of freaking out. And he was like, hey, man, like are you still interested at all? And I was like, yeah, for sure. I'd love to join. He was like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, like, well, I'm going to send you a laptop. And I was like, oh, like, aren't you going to, like, interview me? And he was like, oh, no, fuck that. You got the job. We like, need bodies. I'm like, I'm sending you the info now. Yeah, and so at that the next day, I went to my boss, and I was like, hey, here's my notice. And she was like, what? She was like, I thought everything was going great. I thought you loved working here. And I was like, you know, I didn't say this, but this was my thought. I was like, you people are all like the most NPC people that I could ever find. I didn't even know what an NPC was at the time. I was like, this, to me, this is like the worst existence ever. I'm like living in a prison that's, you know, mental and psychological. I have to wear a suit and tie, you know, like I have to act like I give a shit about sports ball.
You're like, love's a strong word here, love. I mean, you know, we could say tolerate.
I mean, they're all great people, you know, sure. And like it, as far as jobs went, it was a job, but like, I'm not interested in a job. To me, that's slavery. And I hated every moment of being there, not because the people were bad or anything. It was that it just sucked my fucking soul away, you know?
I know.
And so, yeah, so I joined Coinbase. I was like the seventh person on the team. I was a contractor, though, so I like wasn't officially hired until I was like the 30th employee and got fucked out of a ton of equity. But, you know, lesson learned. And, you know, from that point forward, it was just drinking from the fire hose. And it was fun because, like, in my opinion, my time at Coinbase was like me getting my bachelor's degree, like, in Bitcoin, you know. And then I feel like my time at Unchained later on was like me getting my master's degree. So. Oof.
It's so interesting that you attended the Occupy movement like a lot of people did. And it's interesting to me to hear actually that there were some people at that movement, that location that you went to, they're actually discussing Bitcoin because, you know, I attended
my experience has actually been a lot of people that are hardcore Bitcoiners were far leftists that made the conversion through there. Like, Francis from Bull Bitcoin, you know, like we've had some conversations about that. I don't know all of his background, but pretty similar story as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard similar things from other individuals. And to me, like classic liberal ideas from pre-2000, like totally align with Bitcoin. And it makes sense to me from a leftist perspective. Today is what I don't understand. To me, like we are in a extreme post-structuralist narrative on the left, and that has fundamentally captured liberalism on a whole and replaced it with a sort of mutilated version of the socialist liberal.
Yeah, it's really strange because over the last few years, myself personally have realized that I start agreeing with people that I always thought were on the right of the spectrum and was like, well, hang on a minute. And I slowly realized that over time it was actually, oh no, this is just making sense. This is just like intuitive, takes, you know, point of views that just make sense. You don't have to explain them out. You don't have to use jargon, to get your point across. It just inherently, instinctively makes sense. And, you know, I was at the Occupy movement over in London at the time and saw that play out in the city of London. And the point is that I saw a lot of blind eyes and willful blindness, I suppose. And then when it came to the crunch particularly when the media started picking up on it, they just painted everyone as whingers, whiners, loafers, people that were just causing a ruckus for no real reason, et cetera, et cetera. And that was pretty disheartening. But curious to know that there was some people at least the location you were at discussing this Bitcoin thing and got it and understood its potential impact way before, you know.
Well, I think there was like one dude out there like on his mission and like whoever he is.
Galaxy brain somewhere.
Yeah, like, thank you. You know, like, I really appreciate that it was delivered in this very explicit format to me from, like, a masked anarchist during a protest.
What was that journey, though, going from sort of, like, that left-leaning, you know, individual that was quite hopeful for change and was trying to advocate through the political process and everything like that, and then getting sort of defragging your brain the further you studied Bitcoin and began to understood it and I guess, you know, fell down the rabbit hole?
Yeah, the way I say it now is that like that defragging is essentially the return to logic from nihilism. And very similar to your story, like I was well familiar with all of these far left ideas, like specifically in economics. Like I'm well-educated and well-read in modern monetary theory, Keynesian economics. And that was like part of my thesis that I presented during, like in my bachelor's degree, was like how to deal with a currency crisis using a Keynesian approach. And it's funny, I had a really good friend that I used to like have these great debates about between Keynesian economics and Austrian economics. We're always on the opposite side.
Mm-hmm.
And he got orange pilled, and I ran into him in Miami recently, I guess 2 years ago. And it was cool because he was like, like you corrected your perspective. And I'd be like, yeah, man, like I really get how much I screwed the pooch on that one. But yeah, it was great to see that he got Bitcoin as far as I could understand him to. And yeah, it's, in all honesty, I think one of the biggest hurdles with Bitcoin at this point in time is people actually allowing for that defragging to happen and not just like shutting it down as it's occurring. And part of that is like, it's hard, you know, it's hard to realize that so much of the perspective that we've invested in doesn't work, you know? And like, I think a great one is the dialogue currently going on in the green movement about how Bitcoin is, you know, wasteful. And like, it breaks my heart. 'Cause like, this is the most important development for the environmental movement. And the fact that they can't move away from their ideological alignment to see that is very, very disturbing to me.
Yes. Yes. I am in alignment with that, because it just proves to me that either you're, you know, at best intellectually dishonest, or at worst, like a fucking moron, to be honest with you. Because when you are confronted with this reality that doesn't align with your ideology, and you can't pass those two things, you can't recognize it. Oh no, hang on. This is like recognizing it as reality, and you just retreat back into your ideology, to retreat back into your echo chamber, to retreat back into, you know, Plato's cave, really, and find comfort amongst other people that are in alignment with you, and you just continue to forge down this path irrespective of the truth that is confronting you. And if you would just be a little bit more curious, a little bit more intellectually honest, a little bit more humble, and show a bit more humility, you could actually begin to find a path to this thing that you're railing about and trying to, you know, change in the world. It is heartbreaking.
Yeah, I appreciate that you mentioned Plato's cave there.
Yeah,
because to me, like that's part of what's really occurring is that like they, it's not that they're actually like I do think that they're sincere in their alignment and what they desire, but like they think the shadows are real, and when we tell them that they're not, they like can't believe us. And like, to me, like this is why a lot of my work deals with general authoritarianism. 'Cause like, I think we're at a point in the stage of nihilistic development that like the, like thought really is extremely difficult at this point in time. And it's funny 'cause like it relates to this idea of, like don't trust, verify. Like we're trusting most things and not verifying. Mm. And then we just plug in these ideas of what's true, instead of doing the work to understand it's true, we just plug the stuff in. And so when you get a far leftist who sees Bitcoin, they go, well, it uses huge amounts of energy. There's no possible way that could align and be like a good and valuable thing for society. Ergo, it must be bad. So here we are. And it's like, well, hang on. Like, you didn't actually do the work here. Mm. So like, if somebody develops a way to use energy that's more efficient, and that gets that energy in the hands of people at a cheaper rate, who need it more desperately in order to live, like, is this a societal positive? And like, they don't even have the capacity to get there to think about it. And to me, like, this is the most dangerous thing, and the greatest threat to Bitcoin is the incapacity to truly think and to ask yourself to do the work in order to understand that thought. And for me, this is one of the places I struggle the greatest with Bitcoin, and like why I insist I'm terrible at orange pilling people, because, you know, when people are like, well, like, why is Bitcoin valuable? You know, like, I launch off into like an esoteric diatribe on the nature of like what the law is and the sovereign exception in it. And at the end, they're like,
what?
What?
Like a dog that's been showed a card trick.
Yeah, you know, and it's the thing that alarms me the most is when that comes up, most people aren't like, oh, like, I don't understand. Like, what can you do more? It's like that meme where it's like, whoa, that's crazy. Did you see the sports ball game last night? Yeah. You know?
Yeah, the guy at the cookout. It is incredibly frustrating because especially once you go through that orange filter and you start to put sort of that lens on, which arguably gives you enormous clarity, you have these conversations with people prior to passing through that filter, and you begin to recognize that the people that you thought perhaps were in your tribe, so to speak, aren't anymore. And you just will them across the bridge. You're like, come on, like, I can help you. I don't have to go all think boy on you, but I can show you, if you were just a smidge more curious, you could learn so much. The capacity for, enlightenment effectively is so great, but you're stuck believing these shadows on the wall. And the thing that frustrates me with the shadows on the wall nowadays is that there really is no excuse to trust that the shadows on the wall are real, because you have your phone and it is connected to the internet, and you can find effectively the entire, it's like the Library of Alexandria in your phone. That's just, you can access all the information, and then if you can think through it and you can pass what's true and what's not, take what works, leave what doesn't, etc., you really have no excuse anymore to be stupid. I'm sorry, like, you just don't.
I totally agree, but like, we're like stuck at this very initiating phrase where we go, guys, like, turn around and look. There's like sun coming in that's like projecting on us that makes these shadows. And like, they can't even summon in themselves to like turn around to look at that because of what stark ramifications that means for them. And like, I have the truest pity for this, because like, I've lost almost every close friendship I had before Bitcoin to this, and like, I can fault myself for being so insistent upon it. And like, it's hard because like, this is back at like $100 Bitcoin that I am going to my friends being like, this is the most important thing in development today. Like, please, please come. Like, I had a close friend that is a brilliant engineer. And like, I fought tooth and nail to try to get him hired as like one of the first 10 engineers at Coinbase. And he just like was not interested at all, and here we are 10 years later, that like he literally passed up on an 8 to 9 figure sum of money just because he couldn't get past the value sets that I was trying to talk to him about, because he was on the liberal side. I was on the anarchist side. I was trying to convince him a non-state money was essential. And like, he just could not accept it. I even gave him a Bitcoin that he proceeded to sell at $500. And it's been hard because that was one really close friend. Another really close friend, relatively similar story, like, as things continued to develop and escalate, like, I was just very insistent to him that like, this is really important. And to be fair, like, all of these debates would come headlong into like the nature of democracy and republicanism and their functions. But in all honesty, like, the place that stuff really broke down between us is that I always felt like they couldn't take on and respect my ideas, and they felt the same in inverse of that. I was just being too cynical. Right. And from there, we just sort of broke, And I was like, look, like, I'm on this lifeboat and this is where I'm going. You're going in your direction. It's what it is. And in all honesty, I think there started to be a lot of avoidance towards me because, Bitcoin mooned to 10,000, and like, they're like, well, Eric's set now, and I don't know. Like, it's just, it never came back up in conversations between us, and things just sort of fizzled out. And it was harsh. And Gigi's talked about this before, about like, Bitcoin forces you to like burn off a portion of your fiat self. And the truth is that other part of me I had to burn off, and I'm still in the process of it right now. For me, burning off the rest of my fiat self looks like me fully owning Bitcoin in a way that like, I still don't think I've fully stepped into. And I'm called to do that in a way that's very unique and different, because this isn't something I'm forced to do, but like, I feel like I see and understand Bitcoin well enough that like, I want to ask of myself to raise myself up and meet the demands that I think Bitcoin has for me.
I want to move on to the next question, but before I do, I want to just pull on the thread that you mentioned with respect to your friends and that particular friend not getting it, and you know, the idea of just agreeing to disagree, and particularly once it mooned, I think you mentioned, you know, that their assumption was, well, you know, Eric said there's no point discussing this anymore, and you could argue potentially a smidge of jealousy was creeping in at that point. And I it's a concern of mine with respect to, you know, the price movement, where if you take that at scale to effectively the whole world, where everyone just becomes this salty no-coiner that doubles down on their dismissal of Bitcoin to the point where this thing drags out infinitely longer than it ought to, just because their jealousy takes over, the envy, the saltiness, and they just get the unit bias all wrong and everything. And that's a hurdle I kind of think about a lot, particularly as you spiral that analogy out from, say, your own immediate friends and family to, yeah, the whole world, where it's just a long conga line of salty no-coiners just getting all jealous because you were asking them, they didn't listen, and now they feel like they've missed the boat, and, you know.
Oh, I mean, I think it's much, much more dangerous than just salty no-coiners missing the boat. Mm. Like, I think what this develops into is, like, these Bitcoiners are fundamentally endangering our economy, and if we do not stop them with every single ounce of force that we have, they will destroy our world. You know, and like, the to me, like, this is the true existential danger that Bitcoin will present to all of us, and that I think is absolutely inevitable, because Bitcoin is an existential threat to the state as it is today. Mm-hmm. There is no state that exists that can do it without fiat money today. Like, all states will fundamentally transform in light of that. And I think as this comes to play and we do move into a hyperinflationary world, there's going to be an extremely strong narrative of that Bitcoiners are endangering everybody, that this unit of account, like whatever you want to call it, it's threatening to destroy the very fabric of society, and we must stop these people. And it's terrifying because, like, I do very sincerely believe that those same friends in 10 years will be part of that pack of people that will be actively hunting Bitcoiners down to destroy them and take their money. And I'm not sure what to say about it other than, like, this is our task, you know, like, it, if I must be destroyed for Bitcoin to operate in the world, like, so be it. It's not my choice or my desire in any way, but also, like, it can't be stopped. Yeah. And that's what most people don't understand. And that's why, you know, I'm really trying my best to move into a place of the deepest possible empathy that I can have for no-coiners and shit-coiners, because I think it all just reduces down to a fundamental misunderstanding, and I have to continually grant that to them and try my best to convince them. And I don't think it'll work ultimately, but it doesn't mean I shouldn't try.
No, that's the right position to take. It reminds me of the, you know, the 300... the Leonidas at the gates of, what is it, Thermopylae or something like that, you know, where they're confronting the Persians, and that existential shift in their way of life the analogy sort of falls apart there. But my point is that you've got a whole bunch of strongly willed, determined, thoughtful, intellectually honest and curious Bitcoiners standing, trying to shift things to become better, and just this army of brainless NPC Persians that are just rolling over everything because they cannot abide the idea that their lifestyle, so if it's an existential threat against the state and the way that the state exists currently, then by extension it's an existential threat to a lot of people's lifestyle. And so they won't be able to pass that. They won't be able to reconcile that in their brains. And you know, they'll be compelled almost to, as you said, hunt them out and sort of be destructive against this cause. But you have this core group of individuals which identify, I guess, as Bitcoiners that are going to literally fight to the last breath to just be like, I'm not trying to fuck you up. I'm literally trying to make things better here. If you would just come and have a talk, just come and listen, come and research, come and have a chat. Like, we'll get a beer, we'll get a coffee, whatever. It's all good.
I really appreciate that you bring up this idea of 300s and the Spartans of Thermopylae, because I actually started writing something last night and I got quite far in it and then I deleted it because I was like, I don't know where I'm taking this. But I was making the point that, you know, 2,500 years ago at the Battle of Thermopylae, like the Spartans discovered the true power of the shield. And that, like, this, to be clear, like, this was an incident where we had a contingency of 300 Spartans with the support of about 800 different sort of allied tribes, like 800 peoples, stand against an army of that was anywhere from 100,000 to 300,000 men. So they're outnumbered anywhere from 100 to 300 to 1. Like, that's fucking absurd.
Mm-hmm.
And yet somehow in this, because they found this choke point at Thermopylae and that they had perfect defense, they could stand up to that army. Same way that, like, us as Bitcoiners have cryptography, even though we're a tiny contingency against the rest of the world today, we have the shield of cryptography. We can withstand it. They can't go past it. And also, dovetailing off what you said, this is fundamentally about lifestyle. You know, the Greeks and the Persians broke down in their conversation because the Persians would not respect the sovereignty of the Greeks. You know, and that was their conditions, was that, you know, we can work together, but you must respect us as being a sovereign state and people. And the Persians said no. So they went to war about that. Same thing going on here.
Mm.
We are sovereign individuals, and we do not want you to impose your sovereignty over us and make us subjects and slaves to you. And us, by using Bitcoin, we fundamentally refuse that. And to me, that's why my blog is called Crypto Sovereignty, is because I believe that in the new topology that is the internet, vis-a-vis cryptography, we have a totally new and novel form of sovereignty that was not considered before in any unique or powerful way. You know, cryptography has always been part of the art of secrecy and part of war, but it was only in this extreme place at the end of modernity where we had nuclear weapons and computers that cryptography showed this sort of spectacular power it had of the final nature of its unbreakability through this mathematical theorem.
Nuts. Why do you think that you were able and open to discovering Bitcoin?
Oh, I wasn't. I mean, it was like and I've said this before, and it's weird, and I get nervous and anxious talking about it, but like, it's fucked up. But like, I think God very intentionally came to me and delivered a message to me and said, you must follow this. And like, I've never had anything like that happen. And I wasn't religious in any way, shape, or form or seeking that. Like, this is just part of what came up in that manic episode.
Right.
And what's so interesting is that mania came before my discovery of Bitcoin, where God was like, there is something very, very important coming and you must follow this thread. And the sort of funny thing is, like, the bonus of that is, like, at the same time, God was like, you also need to, like, get your hands in soil and, like, achieve food sovereignty. And so, like, that's what I do, like, in my day-to-day life is, like, I have a huge orchard and a vegetable garden and I grow food. Like, cool. This is, and I, like, gather foods from the forest and shit. And, like, I had zero interest or perspective towards that at all before this. In the same way that, like, Bitcoin wasn't this thing I was seeking out or desiring. Like, I didn't, the monetary means of Bitcoin didn't mean anything to me other than my own freedom. And so, like, yeah, I had this insane transcendental experience where, like, I very much had a voice that I think is God come to me and say, there's something really, really important here. Keep following it. And I was just like, okay, I guess this is what I'll do. Yeah, and as I went deeper and deeper down the rabbit hole, the next time that happened for me was in, I guess it was like early 2014. Like I did the largest amount of acid I had ever done. I'd done 250 mix, and I was coming down from it. And I'm not sure if you've ever done acid, but like for me, anytime I smoke a joint after doing acid, it like sets off like a second more intense trip. And so like I was sitting down outside and I started smoking a joint and I was just like thinking about like what Bitcoin is and its nature and how much it blows my mind and how it could transform humanity. And I felt like a lightning bolt hit me and I was just like, this is it. Like, this is your life's work and like what you need to commit yourself to and what you need to go all in on. Yeah. And at that point in time, like I was really deep into kind of my own craziness. And so I started leveraging like as much debt as I could get my hands on into Bitcoin. And it was funny because I had like, I think like five different people in my life come to me and being like, Eric, like this is a terrible idea. Like you are going to fucking destroy yourself. And it's funny because I remember they possibly could. It was kind of embarrassing.
You dropped out just in that last 30 seconds, I think.
Oh, I was just lamenting about more or less how once I really got, like, essentially I had this moment coming down where I really understood on a deep level that, like, this was it. And so at that point, I was just finding as much debt as I could get my hands on leveraging it into Bitcoin. And I had a bunch of friends and family come to me and be like, this is really dangerous. Like, you're going to destroy yourself doing this. And I remember I talked with my partner at the time. And she was like, yeah, like they could be totally right. You could destroy yourself doing this. She was like, but if you don't do this, it'll destroy you more. She's like, if Bitcoin goes to the moon and you don't go all in on this, like you will hate yourself forever. And I was like, oh, that's like a great point.
Wow. So she bought the dip and I presume that you've maintained this relationship over time because that's a remarkable person to you know, flip your perspective like that. That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that partner, her and I, we have plenty of our own difficulties, but she's always been very supportive and kind towards my spiritual mission in life, which for some crazy reason, it seems to be this, you know? And to me, like all this stuff is wild. You know, like I almost every day have a moment where I step back and be like, this blows my mind that like I'm involved with this and this is what my life looks like and what I'm doing. I still pinch myself daily about it.
I was perusing through Crypto Sovereignty a few weeks back. I was trying to write something and I needed to understand a bit more about Heidegger because Heidegger's come up with a number of conversations with some other people.
I'm sorry. I feel like I've cultivated this and like anytime somebody brings it up, I have to apologize. Like Heidegger is so fucking hard. And I remember the first time I picked him up was in 2014. It was like my first foray into philosophy. And I was like, fuck this guy. Mm-hmm. I want nothing to do with him. He's an idiot. And when I came back 2 years ago, I was like, oh, okay, I get why I struggled with this.
Well, thankfully, we've got the internet. I mean, look, if we didn't have the internet and we didn't have YouTube videos to sort of break shit down and like, you know, go on to Crypto Sovereignty, for instance, and get a different perspective to sort of unpack his ideas, particularly in relation to what it was that I was thinking about, you know, I think we'd struggle. It's like if you picked up his book back in the day, I mean, a vast majority of people are going to come away going, fuck, what are you talking about? It's sort of like, I can't remember the fella's first name, but Bourdieu, he talks about habitus and field and all of these things. And I used that a fair bit when I was studying. And I wish I actually have gone deeper into Mises and praxeology and that whole thing, because that's the base layer. But there's a nice tie-in between praxeology and habitus. Anyway, the point is that if you're reading Bourdieu, you're struggling because it's so poorly written or poorly translated. I don't know, because he's obviously writing in French. But with this Heidegger thing, you know, one of the things that sparked a thought while you were talking just before is, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this concept of Dasein, of being there or being in the world, it's a way of him trying to explain that in order to be your most authentic self in the present, to feel most alive and to compel you towards the future, you need to have this this foundation that's located in the past that shapes and orients your personal understanding of yourself. And then you've got this sort of like active anticipation for what's coming next, this sort of projection into tomorrow, which is interesting because it will ultimately culminate in your demise, you know. And so through this sort of mediation between the past, the foundation of the past, and this will to death as you go towards the future, you find yourself in the present. And if you're aware of those two things or three things now coming together, you can then become the most authentic self in the present. You can be Dasein, you can be being in the world. And that's when you find purpose, meaning, and the compulsion to lever up as many credit cards as you can, get into as much debt, and buy as much fucking Bitcoin as you possibly can. Because if you don't, you will hate yourself forever.
Yeah, a bit of that, you know. Dasein was, you know, all the Heideggerian terms can be difficult to struggle with. But when I really realized that, like, Dasein is, it's about, like, the thrownness of your life. That, like, we don't get to pick where we're born. We don't get to pick the circumstances of our family. That, like, you know, we don't get to choose what the rain is like. But all of these things contribute into us and how we see and understand our own existence in the world. And furthermore, only with that projection into the future where we are meaningfully anticipating our own death and what that means in a meaningful way, can we actually integrate this all back into a truly authentic approach to the world. Because the other one that Heidegger is quite critical of is this non-critical approach to the world, where we're not thinking considerately about our own death. And he finds that death is almost like this initiative process in terms of truly understanding what it is to be Dasein. And again, like, these are really hard concepts that I'd like pore over again and again. And I also had to give myself the space to go, okay, this seems kind of wacky and out there, and I don't understand two-thirds of what I'm reading, but I'm just going to keep trying. And to me, like, that was actually one of the most important processes in helping me establish thought, was allowing the space to say, I don't know here, but I'm going to read and I'm going to try to understand, and I'm going to read it again and I'm still going to try to understand. And this is how I understand thought now, is not coming to the right answer, but poring over the question continually and asking if we actually have an adequate answer. Yeah. Which again is also, I think, the fundamental problem when you present Bitcoin to people and they don't get it,
yes,
that they're not actually poring over the question appropriately and truly, because usually you get a lot of straw mans, and I want to see the opposite. I want to see them steel man their own argument. Like, well, okay, if the nation state does work, why have we seen fiat currencies fail? Okay, like, if we do have rule of law, like, why do we see so much injustice in the world? And just asking ourselves permission to truly approach that in a meaningful way where we're not making excuses.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, Eric Voskuhl was on a few episodes back, and he's got some pretty good counterpoints to Bitcoin and the way that it is presumed to succeed. Because I think a lot of Bitcoiners even get caught up in the narratives, and you're talking about plugging bits of truth into this puzzle piece, or this puzzle that you're sort of creating, and you know, these accepted truths, which is fine because you can kind of, they're sort of nice little shortcuts, but if you scale that up to, you know, global population, you can see it getting co-opted fairly easily. I think we had this conversation with Rigel Walsh as well earlier, but it's this idea of when this thing gets so big and so popular and adopted by so many people, it becomes all things to all people, and everyone can bring their own perspectives, but there's a few elements that could potentially mislead quite a lot of other people and maybe corrupt the phenomenon in a way.
Sure. You know, and that's yeah, again, this is why my blog is crypto sovereignty and not Bitcoin sovereignty, is that you know, Clearnet Bitcoin like isn't Bitcoin, you know, in the same way that, like, if Satoshi Nakamoto comes out as like a business professional that's like starting a bank, like it's not the same project anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to me, like, again, this is what the thought behind Bitcoin that's so important is understanding why these things work, you know. And if we wake up tomorrow and we just live in a Bitcoin oriented world where we're on a Bitcoin standard, but people don't understand Bitcoin, well, shit, we're just back on a gold standard, you know. And like that's one, I think that's going to be one of the primary dangers that we're going to see in the late 2020s. Is this everybody needs Bitcoin, but nobody understands what Bitcoin is. And frankly, like, that's our work as educators, is to directly approach that. You know, like, I honest to God don't understand how anyone could live in Argentina as an Argentinian citizen right now,
mm-hmm.
and hold any money in a bank. Like, it seems absolutely fucking bananas to me. And yet somehow in Argentina, Bitcoin still is not the largest political movement. And I don't know what to say about that, other than most people probably don't even know about Bitcoin or unaware of it. In addition to, and this is one of the other things that makes me sad, is like crypto has murkied the waters so much that most people can't meaningfully engage Bitcoin outside of crypto.
Right.
And truthfully, I think that's actually a really, really great and really, really important thing that we needed in order to get here. Because like, I think we very much needed this Trojan horse approach to getting Bitcoin this deep and this far and this developed. And the only way to do that was to like have 80,000 shitcoins distracting with every single motherfucking scam on the planet integrated into that. Cause like now, like, you know, the SEC is so preoccupied with all the other shit going on that they're just like, Yeah. Like Bitcoin's fine. We don't care. We like care about all this other crap going on, you know? and in alliance with like that same story, like I love that essentially, like, from the beginning, we're like, hey guys, like, you guys can't control this cryptography or Bitcoin thing, you know, like here's the great God that we created to celebrate what Bitcoin is as this giant horse. And we want to give it to you guys. But you guys will never be able to bring it inside the state. And at that point, they're like, well, fuck, like, everybody, come on, bring it inside. And we're like, okay, we, like, told you. And who's that one stupid representative from California who, Brad Sherman. Well, so, and, like, Brad Sherman is, like, the Trojan priest who's like, no, this is a trap. Like, don't bring it in.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of challenges, and I think that we're all going to face individually, and that we have to sort of reconcile that's the mission, effectively, without putting too fine Absolutely. A point on it. You know,
you that's know,
the cost I, of doing
I would,
business.
I would really emphasize that, like, we have actually already won, and it's not because like Bitcoin's succeeding, but because Bitcoin has called us to a greater purpose in life, you know? And so for me, like, it's not the money or the freedom, which are phenomenal, and I'm so happy that I have it, but it's the call to a higher purpose and meaning to actually do something in this life that matters, you know? Mm-hmm. Like I could probably be back at that job at the bank working and being just fine, but I wouldn't have a deeper meaning in life. I wouldn't feel a call and a compel that I could offer a better future to my children. At best, I can enhance their comfort in the concentration camp. But what does that matter? Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm. All right, you put it like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and so I just really think it's important to remember that, like, as Bitcoiners, the task we have in front of us is deep and profound and important and meaningful in a way that the world of nihilism cannot offer. Because this is truly a purposeful meaning and thing to do in the world.
Well, and that's why
I welcome people to that.
I reckon that we stand a chance with respect to that 300 analogies, because on one side, you've just got pure nihilism. And then on the other side, you've got hopefulness, purpose, meaning, all of the things that as human beings we do innately respond to. It's just that some respond to it better than others, I suppose. Others maybe suppress that over a long period of time as they grow up and they get to a point where, you know, it's just sort of, it's okay. I can't deal with that because it's so goddamn depressing in light of whatever it is that they're currently doing on a day to day. You know, whereas I've always probably taken the harder road. But knowing that if I don't do that, I'm just going to be an annoying prick to be around effectively. And, and so, you know, it's like, all right, you're not going to, have the safety and security, as it were, but you're going to have the freedom to think and do as you wish, with all the responsibility that comes with that.
The terrifying irony, what you said there with the safety and security, is that just as Benjamin Franklin told us 300 years ago, or I mean, more like 220, is that those who sacrifice essential liberty for security will get neither, you know, and that's where we're at. Most people are so fucking terrified about what is going on because of the way that they have been thoroughly abused as subjects. They're terrified of the idea of a financial meltdown, you know, like you, I mean, man, like you shut off the power in a city for a week, people are flipping the fuck out. They can't take care of themselves in any meaningful way. You know, and I can't help but remember an Emma Goldman quote where she says, look, like the masses are the ones that are screaming and begging for the whips and the chains. Like they're the ones that want more than anything else to be told what to do. You know, and like we got to understand that with how we're trying to liberate them, is that most people aren't ready or prepared for that. And same way, like with the Spartans, like, look, like we're not here to free the Persians. Like a slave class will always be available for the free exploitation of those who want to force themselves onto them. What I want is reserve a space so that those of us that don't want to be slaves have a possibility of liberating ourselves from that, you know? And people don't have an appreciation for how extreme and dangerous both CBDCs and the technological panopticon that's being developed is. You know, like we are truly entering into pretty crazy times. And again, it's one of those things to me that if you can't see the value of a decentralized currency that can't be stopped by anybody in this world, like it's hard to see a way that they are going to get it. And maybe they just have to have a personal event happen to them, but at the same time, like I don't think at any point in time Bitcoiners truly win. I think at best we get a number of spaces that we get to protect and call our own. And I think that's the best we'll do.
Yeah, fair enough. How has discovering Bitcoin changed you?
Well, as I've said a number of times in this call, I think I was myself about it, which I still maintain. You know, I'm spiritually inclined in a way that I would have never anticipated. I identified pretty strongly as an atheist or agnostic before. I don't know, like the big difference is that like all I used to see is nihilistic darkness, and now it's like the opposite. Like even in all of that, I can go, oh, there's like hope and potential, you know, and like really revisiting the metaphysical stuff around Bitcoin to me is the most meaningful, you know, like what I see in cryptography is the last God, you know, in a Heideggerian sense. And that like this, to me, this is what allows for a unification of metaphysics and ethics through the presentation of ethics over metaphysics through a mathematical form. I was debating with somebody on Twitter earlier about this because they were trying to present that Kantian metaphysics and ethics can like never align. And like, while that has been true up till now, Bitcoin explicitly does that through being the metaphysical event that returns all of humanity to logic through the presentation that it has.
Far out.
And again, like, I get that that's like a big mouthful, but you know, like, the in everything that I've read with Heidegger, it's aligned. And you know, there's, I've probably read at least a dozen texts of his so far, including Being in Time and The Event. So like, I feel like I grok Heidegger well enough, mm-hmm. but I still have great trepidation about saying I do actually understand any of this.
Well, that's part of the humility of which I recognize quite a lot in Bitcoiners, is they're willing to do the work and seek the truth and ask the question over and over and over again, and yet even then still not be too confident in what they know. You know, sort of like that Aristotelian kind of concept where I can't remember what he said, but it's something to do with, it's not what you know, it's what you don't know. That it's what you think you know that you don't know that gets you in trouble, whatever it is. Anyway.
Sure. Well, and I think also, like, in, like, what I think is pretty unique is, for me, like, most of this I had established and understood by 2015. And, like, a ton of my work I actually did pre-2017. I'd say, like, half of it, maybe. Mm-hmm. But with that being said, like, I had so much shyness about it that, you know, because, like, here I am trying to say that, like, I have a true metaphysical presentation of what Bitcoin is in a holistic idea of the ontology of man, which again is a mouthful and like a gigantic and huge thing to take on, where I'm like, look, like, I'm some random pleb who just happens to be connecting all of this, you know? Mm-hmm. So like, I don't, you know, and one of the things that really helped me in that is working at Coinbase, I met my, you know, my current best friend, and it was amazing because like, I used to do these introduction to like working at Coinbase things with everybody, where like, I'd do on Fridays, I would come in and do like an hour presentation to all the new hires about Bitcoin. And so when he came in, like, I, like, the interaction was like, hey, I'm Eric. He's like, hey, I'm Jesse. I'm like, you know, I'm going to tell you a bit about Bitcoin. I love Bitcoin because like, there's this whole philosophical approach to Bitcoin that, you know, I think is really, really important that I've been working on. And he was like, oh yeah. He was like, are you familiar with Carl Schmitt? You know, it was funny because I was like, yeah, actually, I was like, I'm really familiar with Carl Schmitt. I'd say like, I probably have some expertise in him. And he was like, whoa, awesome. And we just like launched into it. And so through the cultivation of our friendship and stuff, after a couple of years, he was over at my house and we were hanging out, you know, having a good time. And this conversation came up, you know, where I was like, I don't like, should I, because I published a lot of stuff anonymously before. And I was like, I don't know if I should try to like take my work and like try to present it under my own name. And I really appreciated that he was like, look, he was like, I feel really strongly that in presenting Bitcoin to the world, like while anons and pseudo anons are necessary, like we need to have the courage to stand up and say this under our own names and to take ownership of it in a meaningful way. And he was like, I would really love and appreciate to see you do that. Yeah. And that like love and support really helped compel me to start speaking my truth in the world. And it was really amazing to not only find that people were curious about my own approach, but that people wanted to celebrate it too. And that helped me feel better about myself and what I was doing and gave me the nourishment to continue, you know? And same thing with having these conversations and going to Bitcoin conferences. Bitcoin conferences, more than anything, like I just get this deep, satisfying nourishment where I really understand what we're doing is truly something important in the world, and that I will continue my journey because of the celebration and love that I get through that.
Amazing. I mean, you go from like, so you were identifying before as like an anarcho leftist around the Occupy movement.
I would have identified myself before the Occupy movement as a far left socialist,
right?
And moving into communism as it came along,
mm-hmm.
and then through Occupy, I'd say I was then a leftist anarchist who then started to go through the full turn,
mm-hmm.
and then today most people would probably label me as being a right wing anarchist, which is a label I also reject. Mm-hmm. But you know, it is a more conservative thread of anarchism specifically that I think fundamentally unify is in alignment with the classic idea of what anarchism was, which is libertarian socialism.
Yeah. Yeah. That whole spectrum does my head in nowadays. But I guess the, the thought there was, it's transformed you as you've learned about all these things, and you've been pulling in all of these different philosophical ideas, and then are sort of aligning them, or at least it's like Bitcoin is the cornerstone of this masterpiece that you're working on, and you're fitting in all of this different thought from beforehand. And you mentioned before you're a random pleb with these ideas, but I mean, to an extent, you could argue that Carl Schmitt was, or Isaac Newton, or Plato, Socrates, Heidegger. They're all just like people that are just so compelled to understand something about the world that they must get it out in any way, shape, or form. And it just so happens that within their historical context, it resonated at a frequency that allowed other people to pick those ideas up. Whereas I think we're moving into that era where there will be, I mean, you are working on a book, right?
Yeah, it is completed at this point in time. We're just going through the editorial stuff. It's mostly, most of it is the essays that are already featured at Crypto Sovereignty. There's a couple extras that aren't in there, mm-hmm. but in all honesty, the reason I released it was because, one, I just wanted like something to present as like, hey, here's a bunch of my ideas. But in that presentation, to me, like, this is almost the preliminary foundational view that I have. That's really kind of an amalgam constellation of my various ideas that now I'm working on, like, what I would call my second book, which is really going to be applying Heidegger's ideas from contributions of philosophy, the event, to Bitcoin. And it's funny because, like, some people have misinterpreted what I've said as Bitcoin being the event, but it's more about through the lens of Bitcoin, we're returned to this non-egotistical form of logic that is only possible in our current world and our thrownness within that world. Mm-hmm. And that's why Heidegger is such an important approach, is because, and this is one of the things that pisses me off about other people that, you know, reject Heidegger, is that to me, Heidegger is the only current philosopher that correctly interprets Nietzsche and allows for Nietzsche's understanding to push itself into modernity with a correct understanding of being within that. And that, like, only through that very specific understanding of being in a post-nihilistic world does the logic of Bitcoin then create such a metaphysical new beginning. And it's only by, like, how we're trapped in modernity and the nihilism that is the authoritarianism of statism and fiat, in the way that they've tried to replace truth itself with those authoritarian decrees that they call correct.
Yeah. I remember reading Anthony Giddens back when I was at uni. I don't know if you've ever encountered any of his work, but he talks a lot about post-modernity and modernity and how, you know, it's kind of, a lot of that stuff resonated with me. But what I've found interesting since, you know, discovering Bitcoin is that there's going to come a time when I'm going to be able to follow down those threads and not be fearful that I'm sort of wasting time, you know, because a lot of these things, there's a lot of people in the world that want to read about these ideas and explore these things, but they may not have the resources, the time, the energy, etc., to do it. And I think if we transition to this, you know, hyper Bitcoinization world, whatever, where we're able to actually accrue an amount of savings that allow us to free up that time and energy to pursue whatever it is that we want to pursue. The amount of ideas that are going to be unleashed into the world that are just mind blowing. It's already happening with things like, you know, your writings, but I think about John Vallis wrote something a few years ago, I think a couple of years ago, writing about the instantiation of God and taking those Jordan Peterson things. And I was reading that, just having my mind blown. And then, you know, Knut Svenholm's work and all of these sorts of things. That's the kind of world that I want to live in, is where, like, we have these people that are thoughtful and making contributions to people's lives in ways that they may not even comprehend. That's the thing. your work, your books and stuff, they may hit within the Bitcoin community supercharged, and then they'll slowly over time, and I'm talking centuries here, just find their way into the right hands of some bright young mind that's curious about this thing. And it's like, whoa. And then they stand on your shoulders, and then someone else stands on their shoulders. And then, you know, that's how we propel everything forward to incredibleness, I suppose. I don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, like, to me, like, and this is, you know, why I have that essay called Bitcoin is Messianic. It's that one, it, because, like, if we don't go into that world where we return to logic, like, we do descend into darkness where it is just a boot stomping on a human face forever. Mm. And furthermore, that, like, the technological techniques of the Panopticon, particularly with the development of advanced general AI, like, this is all extremely dangerous to humanity on a whole. And the potentiality of extricating ourselves from that has a very explicit tone of danger that is more extreme than a nuclear holocaust, in my opinion. And I speak about how, like, we can clearly already see this with the Chinese development of their Panopticon and the way that they're performing what I have called, in the Uyghur genocide, the perfect genocide, because it's not actually about killing the people anymore. It is about completely destroying their culture and making them into absolutely vacant bodies that are much more effective than slaves could have ever been. It's because if you destroyed every single cultural iota of their existence, and now they only exist to be a vacant husk for the state. And that's the perfect genocide, because now you get workers that will work themselves to death for you, and you no longer have to promise them freedom.
And nobody recognizes it or talks about it or anything. It's like all done out in the open. It's happening. Everyone's fairly well aware of it, relatively speaking. And yet, yeah, it's just,
yeah. And so you go to Uyghur children and they say, I'm Chinese. I only speak Chinese. China is my culture. Xi Jinping is my president, who I love and who helps me and celebrates me and my people, you know? And when you go, well, what about your native tongue? What about speaking Uyghur? And they're like, water?
It's just obliterated identity, like thousands of years of culture. Just.
Yeah. And to be clear, this is the second iteration, and the Chinese were able to implement this because they were so effective about doing it through the Cultural Revolution. So, like, this is sort of familiar to them, and it rhymes. And, like, this is the model that the WEF and other individuals see having been implemented in China successfully, that they want to implement everywhere else in the world. You know, because to be clear, for governments, this is a phenomenal system. For them, it works really, really well. But for those of us who still have some...
The logic of the state recognizes that that's, yeah, a tremendous thing, because that's the logic of the state, is to just harvest bodies for tax purposes, to grow and become bigger and bigger and bigger, and to hell with the outcomes. It's all about the process.
Well, and you said the correct word there. It's the logic of the state. And the danger that we live in today is that people replace the logic of the state with their own logic. And they say that the logic of the state is logic itself. It is natural logic. And this is where we start to get how people are able to integrate all of these contradictions in the world, because, and this is what Hobbes said in Leviathan, the first, you know, true book that was on statecraft, was he said, it is authority, not truth, that makes legitimacy. And it is no wonder at the end of 500 years of development that now we've gotten to a place where people fundamentally believe what the state says is true is actually truth in nature. And this fucks everything up, because this is how we literally have a measurement of value that has fundamental accounting errors at the bottom of it. Mm-hmm. And that can be thoroughly manipulated and contorted based on that. And when you point that out to people, they simply go, well, you know, that's the best way to do it. You know, they just circumnavigate trying to actually address the true logical portion of it, because the state tells them that's okay.
Yeah, it allows for it and it validates it. And so you don't have to, you don't have to do any more work to contradict that. That's why it's so confronting when you start reading up on a lot of the libertarian stuff and anarcho-capitalist stuff. I mean, anyone that's come from a leftist sort of leaning bent and dived into something like The Ethics of Liberty from Rothbard, you're just like, what? But if you're intellectually honest enough, you'll be like, but that kind of makes sense. That's the fucked up thing. And so then you propel yourself, if you can, to read more, dive into all sorts of other things, Hopper, etc. And it doesn't jive with what you've been thinking. Like we were saying at the top of this call was, you know, the ideology, you can either retreat back into the cave at that point and double down, or you can keep going and finding new and more radical ways of thinking, which aren't even radical, they're just logical, and it actually helps you grow as an individual. It's you know, but the problem is, and you have to have conversations with people that aren't down that rabbit hole, and then you're just like, fuck.
Well, and I want to be clear that like the very first step in that journey is unequivocally the hardest, because like, you know, you like read Rothbard, because some of this makes sense, like. And then you like go to your families and friends and you go, hey guys, like I've been thinking, like are our tax dollars really used to build the roads, or is it used to kill brown people? And they're like, what? They're like, whoa, hey, Jesus Christ, you can't just start a fucking conversation that way. Man, like I just wanted you to ask me about the score last night.
The sports ball.
Like, well, yeah, we'll get to that, bro. But like, is like taxation like a legitimate thing? And they, and again, they're just like, get the fuck out of here, man. Like, I don't want to think about that. No, you know? And so like everyone around you is punishing you and telling you this is terrible. And in all honesty, I think there's a lot of people that at that point when they just go, yeah, I'll take the blue pill. And you're like, really? They're like, yeah, fuck this. I just want to wake up back in bed and, you know, see what the score is and watch some Teletubbies. That's all I'm interested.
That's Cypher in the Matrix, right? It's just want to get back to that juicy steak.
Yeah, you know, and to be clear, like there's a sizable portion of the population who get that, you know. I think it's interesting that like I know this guy, he's old school lawyer, crazy smart guy, you know, and I present to him like, hey, this Bitcoin thing's like really important, like you need this. And to him, he's just like, look, like I've tried to look into that and like, no, I'm not interested. Mm. And it's like, well, hang on. He's just like, no, I'm going to go home and have my glass of wine. Sorry.
Wow. I mean, it'd be interesting to know what his incentives are or whether or not they're already squared away, et cetera. So, you know.
I mean, he used to be a DA. So, I mean, like he's status through and through. So.
Right. What have you learned about the world and about yourself since discovering Bitcoin?
I've learned about myself that there are depths and knowledge and places that I could have never anticipated or known without being compelled by Bitcoin and more specifically Bitcoiners. Mm. And what I've learned about the world is that the world is an extremely deceitful place, not by nature, but by necessitation. And that while things look extremely dark today, that darkness is part of a whole story of humanity going through the cycles of the agony to have been extricated from the truth of logic. And now we're returning to that. And in that return is the greatest thing that could ever happen. You know, to me, it's messianic to literally come from a world of total darkness and lies and falsehoods and nothing has meaning and all truth is subjective to one where that is actually a lie. There is truth. There is meaning. There is purpose. And you can make this world a better place for your children and all of posterity by insisting upon this ethical form of money that can end the lies and the deceit, and most specifically, the violence of fiat money. you know, and to me that is the greatest of all spiritual callings, to be able to participate in that, I truly think is a messianic calling.
I don't have anything to add to that. I think that's incredible.
Thank you.
Yeah, that foundation, that pillar of truth that we can all operate on, that rules, that's that rule set, a set of rules, that there's no changing to that. It's just, this is the game now that we play. We're not changing the rules at the end of the quarter or the first half of the basketball game or football game or whatever. It's set. We got 60 minutes to play this thing, 90 minutes to play this thing. Do your best.
It's funny because when we say it that way, like it's almost absurdly laughable that like we're this deep into this conversation and like this is the core thing we want to convey to people that people still aren't getting, is that like we just want fair rules around money and wealth. That's it. We don't want it to be biased towards anyone for any reason at any point in time by any means. And like, it's laughable to me that this isn't something that people are like, oh, well, yeah, like obviously, like that's what we want, you know, like it. And I think like when we get 100 years in the future and people are like, tell me about fiat, and you like do the whole explanation, they're like, so like governments just like made up these coupons and gave them to people and people believed it. And I'll be like, well, you know, like they'd like violently hurt you if you didn't take it. And they're like, oh, okay. That's weird.
It's a bit like, I know you guys don't have time zone in the States. We have time zone in here over here. It's like,
no,
like,
we have time zones.
Right.
We even like change the time twice a year just to like fuck with everybody.
No, I'm talking, so we have like an arcade brand called Time Zone here, and you have tokens, okay. And it's like, you know, you win tokens as you play the games and stuff. So I could have just said like the carnival, the fair, Chuck E. Cheese, whatever. The point is that
Dave and Buster's, yeah.
Fiat, living on in a fiat world, on a fiat standard, it's basically like being compelled to just live at the fair or at the carnival with all the bread and circuses, and just being issued these tokens or playing these games that are just arbitrarily changing. And then you got someone, you know, just printing more tokens out the back somewhere, and we're all just being violently coerced to just keep playing skee ball. Okay, shut the fuck up and just play the pinball machine or whatever it is. And we just want to sort of get out of this fun house that's just not fun anymore.
I really appreciate that analogy because furthermore, like like all of us rich people are like stuck into going into this place where we're paying highly over for every piece of merchandise. All of the bullshit we're being sold doesn't actually sell, like doesn't actually meaningfully change our lives in any way.
The quality of it sucks. In addition
to all of the people there are explicitly exploited people, and usually like immigrants and other people that are like being explicitly harmed through their role like at that fair. So like, yeah, that's a really excellent analogy. And like some assholes printing out tokens to like sell us a giant bunny. And like, meanwhile, we're like trying to actually like find like a meaningful and purposeful life. And they're like, yeah, like, if you like win 10,000 skee ball tickets, you can like buy a home. And we're like, oh shit. Like, give me more money. I got to keep skee balling. Okay. I'm like in $300,000 worth of debt now, but like I bought a one room studio.
With a glimpse of the ocean.
Yeah. Well, you can see like the reflection on like the ceiling of the other building or something.
Nice. Nice. So you take what you can get these days. How do you explain Bitcoin?
In all honesty, I usually tell people I'm really bad at this. Like if you really want to know about Bitcoin, I have a really great book on my bookshelf called 21 Lessons by my friend Gigi.
Great book.
I'll give it to you if I want it, you know? I usually look, yeah. And then I'm like, but like, I'm only going to give it to you if you're actually going to read it. And like the next time we're going to talk, I'm going to like ask you explicit questions about it. And like, you need to answer that. And usually they're like, well,
sounds like work.
Funny enough, my ex's grandmother, who's like 87, she's like one of the one people that like took the book and actually read it, which I really appreciate. But yeah, I usually tell people, you know, and if people are like, no, really, like I'll like give them the full fire hose and I'll be like, look, like Bitcoin really is the most important thing that's happening technologically in the world today, because it addresses all of the problems and issues that we're seeing between politics and money today. And so you understand and see how the price of milk versus 5 years ago is twice what it is, and the same with eggs. Like, this isn't a fundamental economic function that has to happen. This is because during COVID, they printed out trillions of dollars and gave it to the richest people in order to enrich themselves at your direct expense. And and this is going to get much more extreme over the next decade. And if you actually want to be able to defend yourself in a meaningful way, like, you really need to have Bitcoin. And every single question that you have about Bitcoin, there is an answer out there that somebody has made. You just have to do the work to understand it. And then usually at this point, they're like, well, why not gold? And I'm like, again, do your research. Someone has answered why Bitcoin is better than gold. And in all honesty, like, this is one of the major problems with Bitcoin, is that, like, you, in my opinion, you really need about 1,000 hours of true research into it between the fields of sovereign exceptionalism theory, legal theory, economic theory, computer science theory, Austrian economics, you know, and like those five things in and of themselves, most people don't know anything about them. And so even with that 100 hours, you're pretty much going to get up to a baseline where I'm not even sure if that's even going to get you to a place of where you understand the value of Bitcoin.
I think that's part of the hero's journey, though, is that ability to put in that compulsion to put in those hours. So when you first clock up that first hour, if you're not juiced or energized to continue to get that second hour, third hour, and so forth, I guess that's where the meme "have fun staying poor" or "not going to make it" comes from. Because I don't know anyone that has seriously considered Bitcoin, thought about it, read about it, studied it, maybe bought some, that hasn't propelled them down this rabbit hole that is just amazing.
You know? It's interesting you bring that up, because that sparked in my mind. I remember after reading that Wired article, that, like, I remember I was really worried because I thought that I had, like, kicked off like another manic episode, because I stayed up for like 2 days just like going through the Bitcoin forums, like trying to read every single thing I could about Bitcoin, being really excited about it. And I remember that was, you know, really kind of the first part of me getting it, you know? And I've heard that story from many other people, that when they like first really got Bitcoin, that it was like a pretty obsessive thing where they were trying to study as much as they could to understand it.
Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt. Particularly if you have some sort of obsessive compulsive personality, where you sort of latch on to your own personal current thing, as it were. The cool thing about this is that it's an anchor to all of these things. And so if you are of a curious nature, you can effectively run it as the keel, and then just as long as you, what do they call it? Damn, the analogy was working so well. Unfurl the sail and you got a right gust of wind, you can go anywhere in the world. You know,
that's a nice sailing analogy I hadn't heard before.
I've been reading Leela a little bit again, just trying to get my head
around. Oh, nice!
Those concepts.
Reed Love. He's a really big fan of that book.
Yeah, he is. His series with Mike Hill kind of triggered that. And you know, for anyone listening, I'd highly recommend the book, because this idea of the metaphysics of quality and dynamic static patterns of value. It's a whole new podcast. You could go off and listen to the What Is Money show with Mike Hill. Highly recommend it. But I'm trying to sort of incorporate that into my POV for a moment, just to see if it can kind of fit and frame up some other things that I think about. So anyway, the point is that you find yourself at the precipice of this Bitcoin rabbit hole, and it's effectively yours to fall down in any which way you wish, and no one can tell you what you get from it. Only you just got to do the work, right?
Yeah. And the thing, you know, I'm like, I haven't, it's funny because like I'm trying to think about it and I now think that I've never actually ran into it. But like in the same way that like you can start doing that work and you're free to just be like, this is fucking stupid and put it down and walk away. Mm-hmm. I've never met anybody that that's actually happened to, you know, I'm like, I've never met anybody who's actually put the work in to understand Bitcoin deeply who didn't get it. The very best I get are like crypto sycophants who will be able to get enough of it through their own obscure perspective that they can be like, but like the internet computer protocol will be the future because I said, you know, it's like, no, like you got, you're like missing a bunch of points, including like the CIA showing up to like beat you with a wrench. this was just a debate that I had with the founder of that protocol at Burning Man when I was high on acid once. Yeah, me and my that same friend Jesse, we like tromped into like the Ethereum camp at Burning Man. That Burning Man super high, and we're like, debate us about Bitcoin. It was a lot of fun.
That would have been amazing. I can't imagine a bunch of Ethereums at Burning Man.
Yeah, you know what's really funny is actually there's a dude who I ran into Miami last year. Really great guy, and we had a great conversation. But he was like, "Hey man, like, do you remember like when you were at Burning Man in 2017 that this guy like his tarp blew away and it like crushed yours?" And I was like, "Oh yeah, for sure." He was like, "That's my brother, and you like orange pilled him super hard, and then he orange pilled me super hard." And I was like, "What the fuck?" So it. Really great guy. Yeah, I've seen him a bunch of times. He's like a Bitcoiner through and through. So shout out Bondi Hold.
There you go. Throw a stone, man. See what ripples, you know, energize out.
Rapidly. Yeah, and in the same way, like running into people that I had a great podcast about a couple weeks ago. And the guy was saying, yeah, like after reading your material around the question concerning Bitcoin, I like picked up Heidegger again. And I read the question concerning technology a bunch of times and he like went really deep and I told him, I was like, I'm so over the moon at just knowing that like my thought influenced you in this way. And like, I feel really honored and respected. So like, thank you so much for calling me. And you know, he had great questions and we got to go really deep into the essays, which is what I really want. You know, I'm hoping that I'll do my own podcast series based off of my book where we just do like these really deep dives on each of my essays, trying to discuss and debate it, you know?
That'd be amazing to listen to. I look forward to the first episode. I can't wait. Eric, this has been an awesome conversation. They're always awesome, but this one in particular, it's really cool to pull on some threads we don't normally get to pull on.
Yeah, this. Thank you. I really appreciate the thoughtful and poignant questions.
Oh, well, dude, I try my best to keep up with these things. I always find myself just talking to people that are infinitely more thoughtful and intelligent than me, and I just kind of keep up as best I can. And the point is that I appreciate the fact that you've expended some of your scarce time and finite energy telling us how you discovered Bitcoin.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very happy to share my story and, yeah, I hope it's helpful for some people. And, I guess on a parting note, I'd just say, look, like I get how wacky all of this seems and like how sort of ETH rolling out there it all is enough to like make you be like, this can't be real, but it is. It's just, we just live in probably the most unique time and space that we could. And as I've said, like we all have our own personal roles and tasks in this, you know, just yours is to help understand other people's particular way that they discovered Bitcoin. Mine is through philosophy and, you know, everybody has their own approach. And I think together through these open and robust discussions, we're all going to learn stuff.